Okay, I think we're going to get into our final session here. The censorship session, which to me is always topic number one in my mind and in this Global Liberty Institute. Everything depends on free speech, in my simplistic way of saying it. So our final panel is called Free Speech Today in Free Societies. And we have three legal scholars who we're very fortunate to have educate us from Germany, from the United States, and from the United Kingdom. And I'll give very brief introductions. Joachim Steinhoffel is a very prominent attorney, probably the most important litigator of free speech, cancel culture, whatever you want to call it, in defending and pushing back on how that has really taken hold in Germany. John Yu is the Heller Professor of Law at University of California, Berkeley, has many titles, including one of my best friends. And he is a leader in constitutional law as a scholar and has worked inside the government in very trying circumstances. And then our third is Andrew Tettenborn, who is a professor and chair in law at Swansea University in the United Kingdom, who has graciously continued to participate in this conference, even though he was very, very ill and couldn't come. So we have him hooked in by Zoom, I guess, or it's not necessarily almost connected. So maybe we should start with someone else first. With some opening remarks, as we've done before. We'll go to the three speakers to give their opening remarks and then have a discussion. Joachim, why don't you begin?
Okay, thank you very much. Dear Scott, thank you for the invitation. It is a privilege to speak about free expression before a room that includes leading scholars and senior transatlantic officials. And diplomacy, we, or one, often say alliances are built on interests and values. Interest shifts, values are supposed to endure. Free speech is one of those, non-negotiable in any society that calls itself free. Let me state the thesis plainly. In today's Germany, the primary threat to free speech no longer comes from private platforms. It comes from the state and from a growing ecosystem of state-funded proxies. I'll start with a scene that should unsettle anyone who grew up with the rule of law. An elderly man near Bamberg in Germany is woken at 6 in the morning by police for calling the economics minister a Schwachkopf, fool, online, raided at dawn for an alleged insult. Ask yourself, what kind of political culture conducts pre-breakfast raids over petty speech? Everyone can say what he wants, we are told by government officials, yes, until the doorbell rings. A second example goes beyond petty. Earlier last year, a journalist was sentenced to a suspended 7 months jail term for a meme reading, "I hate freedom of expression," a satirical image put into the Interior Minister's hands as a critique of her stance on free speech, which manifested itself inter alia in her unlawful closure of a far-right newspaper, unlawful according to the Federal Administrative Court. A punishment fit for a dictatorship masqueraded as the defense of democracy. Prosecutors have appealed, seeking a harsher penalty. If you want to know what a chilling ethic looks like, that's it. In connection with the Bamberg case, I posted the following on X. The Bamberg judge responsible for this judgment is Martin Waschner. Anyone who hands down such judgments should not be a judge in a free state, nor have the power to jail free citizens for lawful speech. For that, the Hamburg Bar Association opened disciplinary proceedings against me. They are, of course, absurd. I contested them vigorously, and of course, I will prevail. Third, Germany's Interior Ministry under Nancy Faeser, previous administration, commissioned a report that smeared the distinguished journalist Henrik M. Broder, We took the matter to court. The Higher Administrative Court of Berlin-Brandenburg enjoined the ministry. The report was pulled offline and the remaining printed copies were pulped. The FAZ, leading German daily, summarized the outcome with crisp understatement, Broder blamiert Innenministerium. Broder embarrasses the Interior Ministry. That wasn't a close call. It was a reminder that a government has no constitutional right to be spared mockery and certainly not a right to defame its critics. Fourth, the Federal Constitutional Court reaffirmed that point in a case we brought for Julian Reichelt against the federal government. Reichelt is a journalist and former chief editor of Germany's biggest daily. A cabinet minister sought to muzzle his tweet, commenting about hundreds of millions of so-called development aid to Afghanistan, calling it money for the Taliban. The government went against the journalist and this tweet and obtained a restraining order. The Constitutional Court humiliated the government, lifted the restraining order, and stated a violation of the civil liberties of the journalist. Political speech, especially harsh, unsettling speech, sits at the core of Article 5 of our basic law. Finally, my own case with the Federal Office of Justice, an authority overseen by the Ministry of Justice, shows how far officialdom will go to make a critic's life difficult. After a court ordered the office to give me access to a file, the agency stalled, erected new obstacles, and then sought sanctions with the Hamburg Bar Association because I criticized the responsible civil servant as subordinate and incompetent for ignoring that order. A state authority that treats a binding court order as optional does not defend the rule of law, it erodes it. My motion for a restraining order versus the federal government for its request to sanction me rests with the appeals court for more than 7 months now. These are not anecdotes, they form a pattern. Senior German politicians, particularly from the Greens, have normalized mass filings of criminal complaints over criticism that is often lawful but inconvenient. Police resources are diverted to the feelings of the powerful. And when the state loses in court, it often shrugs and tries something else. A pensioner was sentenced to an 800 euro fine for a comment about the former German Secretary of State, Baerbock. He posted, "Hit the ceiling too often while jumping on a trampoline." I commented on X, "That is their true face, the ugly, semi-totalitarian grimace of the Greens, humorless, merciless, cold, disgusting." And as a consequence, criminal investigations were launched against me. Section 188 of the German Criminal Code regulates insults, defamation, and slander directed at persons in political life. The section provides for a higher penalty if a politician is insulted. All animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. There is a second, more strategic front, outsourcing repression. Under our constitution, the state must remain neutral in the political contest. So it funds so-called civil society organizations to do what it may not do openly: surveil, flag, and stigmatize lawful speech, launch warfare, and condition the public debate. That is not policy. That is propaganda bought with taxpayers' money. It stimulates consensus by financing the chorus. Layered on top of this is the EU's Digital Services Act, the operating system of Europe's content control industry. The DSA applies to any service with users in the union, backed by fines up to 6% of global turnover. It deputizes trusted flaggers, elevates state and parastate notices, and tells platforms to move fast or else. Illegal content is defined by the most speech-restrictive law anywhere in the EU. In crises, the Commission may order risk mitigation measures, elastic enough to mean whatever yesterday's panic demands, including throttling lawful discussions under the banner of disinformation. The predictable result isn't just takedowns of the illegal, it is overblocking of the lawful, shadow bans of the inconvenient, and the quiet freezing out of dissent by compliance departments terrified of Brussels. That isn't adjudication, it's administrative censorship at scale. A brief doctrinal reminder, because principles matter. The German Constitutional Court has said for decades, the state must tolerate sharp, even wounding criticism. The line to smear is a narrow exception, not a default. In cases of ambiguity, courts must choose the non-punitive reading, and a government, unlike a citizen, has no honor to protect via criminal law. These aren't decorative quotes, they are functional guardrails. They may not be removed. But we have a bureaucracy that polices satire and politics that pathologizes dissent. Some access the text module box, but this is about hate and incitement. Let's be serious, this is vulgar boilerplate. A dawn raid for fool, a 7-month sentence for a meme, a ministry report pulped after it tried to kneecap a journalist, a cabinet minister asking the Constitutional Court to sterilize a political statement. This isn't about protecting minorities or preventing violence. This is about protecting power from embarrassment. There's also a legal culture point. Freedom of expression is not a courtesy extended by rulers to well-behaved subjects. It's a constraint on rulers enforced by courts and citizens. Once you allow officials to collapse the difference, you invite a politics of permanent sensitivity with criminal law as its concierge. That is the game in Germany today. Expand the list of speech taboos, inflate harm, outsource the policing to compliant NGOs and platforms, and call it safety. What is to be done? 3 straightforward points. First, decriminalize thin-skinned politics. Reserve criminal law for true threats and genuine incitement as narrowly and clearly defined by courts, not for rude adjectives or memes. If your feelings require protection by prosecutors, public office may not be for you. Second, defund the proxy armies. Taxpayer money cannot be used to launder political combat through NGOs. If a state actor could not lawfully censor directly, it cannot lawfully fund an intermediary to do it by notice, rating, or risk mitigation. Third, discipline the regulators. The DSA must not become a permanent exception regime. Any emergency power should be time-limited, reviewable in real courts, and strictly bound to legal content as defined by law and precedent, not policy fashion. Trusted flagger status should require judicially reviewable standards and liability for abusive or negligent flagging. I wrote about transatlantic politics. I welcome without reservation the steps the US administration has taken to push back against the EU's regulatory adventurism and speech governance, including the willingness to consider sanctions or tariffs where extraterritorial digital regulation becomes a tool to export censorship. That is not a trade spat, it's a defense of a civilizational norm. If Europe insists on building a compliance panopticon, it should not expect to set free speech standards for the free world. Let me end on the positive. Free speech does not guarantee truth, it guarantees the possibility of finding it together. It grants citizens the right to make fools of themselves and the duty to tolerate the foolishness of others. It keeps governments honest if they are willing, and when they are not, it gives courts and advocates the tools to remind them. In the past year alone, German courts have shown those tools still work. An interior ministry rebuked and embarrassed, a cabinet minister told she may not gag a critic, a justice agency dragged back to the law. And yes, even after 6 a.m. doorbells and anti-hate theatrics, the principle stands that mocking the state is a constitutional right. That principle is worth defending loudly and without apology. Free speech is not a favor from the powerful. It is the people's shield against the powerful. If Europe forgets that, the United States should remind it. Not with lectures, but with policy. And we, on our side of the Atlantic, must do our part, litigate, legislate, and refuse to be intimidated by the new clarity of safety. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me back to speak with you. And it's a pleasure to speak in front of people who, like Joachim and many of you in the audience, have had your own experiences with censorship and the effort by both private and public authorities to try to suppress disfavored opinions. And you know, Scott Atlas is a great paradigm, I think, of how to fight through that and to still get your message out and to be a our societies need contrary voices to question government policy all the time. Even when I was in government, I hated it, but I was glad that there were always critics to test what the government was doing. Just three very quick points, because we don't have a lot of time. One, I think in the United States, as opposed to Europe, I think the main threats to freedom of speech are not really coming from the government. They're coming from private actors, networks, the social media networks on the one hand, and then also the cultural institutions, primarily universities. The worst is when the government combines with either of those institutions to try to suppress disfavored speech, as we saw during the COVID-19 pandemic and the treatment of critics of the nationwide lockdown policies and mandatory vaccine requirements. Second point is, I think in the United States, we're still trapped in an industrial revolution paradigm where we think of speech through the lens of thinking about newspapers, essentially. And the idea that, well, if a private person owns a newspaper, they get to decide what's printed and the government can't force them to print something they don't want to. And that idea goes back to the idea of private property being land, where you can put your campaign poster up on your property and no one can force you to put theirs on your property. The question is whether the social media networks really are equivalent to these past notions of speech and private property. And I would say what we're moving towards in the United States slowly is treating social media networks like utilities, where, for example, United Airlines can't say only Democrats can or progressives can only fly United. Although that wouldn't be bad, because then they would never get anywhere on time, which is terrible for a progressive if you think about it. It's because their whole idea is they have to progress on time. You don't have electricity and utility, water companies can't say, we're only gonna hook up Republicans, right? We think of, these are called common carriers. We think of certain kinds of networks as being responsible for a public service for which they're not allowed to ideologically discriminate. And I think we are gradually seeing the American system start to treat social media networks in this way. Still allowed to make money, still allowed to make large profits, but because they have such market dominance in their industries, they're not allowed to carry out ideological discrimination. Last point I'll make is, and this goes to the point of remedies. If you think that the real threats to freedom of speech are coming from social media companies, internet networks, or cultural institutions like the universities, what's the best solution? We're accustomed to, I think, the approach that Joaquim laid out that is very much an American legal approach too, which is you go to the courts and you get the courts to enjoin the defendants to stop doing what they're doing. I wonder whether that's going to be most effective. If we don't trust the government itself to be fair and free speech, if you think about the way we think about in the legal system, we're asking the government to restrain itself in its violation of freedom of speech. And I don't think the government can be trusted. If you want to take a good example of this, look at the Murphy versus Missouri, which was the case that even though the Supreme Court would not reach the merits of the case, revealed incredible level of cooperation between the Biden White House and Facebook and Twitter and YouTube to suppress criticism of the way the authorities handled the COVID-19 pandemic. It's just an incredible level of intertwined relationships, even though the courts ultimately did not reach the question whether the government was compelling social media. It seemed apparent to me social media wanted to cooperate with the government anyway, even if it wasn't compulsion, because they shared the same attitude that speech is not about the marketplace of ideas of brutal competition and criticism, but that speech was kind of like a cultivated garden where the government and social media were the gardeners, and we all happened to, I guess, be flowers in the garden. Right? So question is, do you really trust that government to correct its own violations of freedom of speech. And I'll throw this out, and here is maybe the answer is in your hands, because I think the answer might actually be from competition to these social media networks, competition to universities. So I'm voting with my feet. I'm going to join the University of Texas, which is creating a new school of civic leadership, which is designed to present an alternate approach to higher education than the ones we saw perhaps in the Ivy Leagues, where I noticed many of you, including myself, went, where I think we see the worst sort of voluntary speech self-censorship that we've seen in American history going on right now, to the level where Jewish students are harassed by students and staff and faculty members without any compulsion by the government. They just do it because they think that's the right thing to do, and they use their power on campus to suppress disfavored speech, disfavored points of view. Perhaps the thing we should be doing is setting up alternate businesses, which are going to provide other options and outlets for freedom of speech beyond the existing social media networks, beyond the control of government, and we're going to see alternate forms of cultural institutions, like new kinds of universities, new kinds of, say, museums. We're relying now, we're talking about now in the United States about Donald Trump and his executive orders are in a way an effort to do that, but should we trust the government with this important task actually of protecting freedom of speech, or should the onus be on you and your generation trying to, right? Think of what's the free speech alternative or free speech parallel to cryptocurrency, right? Something outside the control of government that will allow freedom to flourish. So I think that's your generation's task. We've screwed up free speech enough in our generation, and so put the onus on you. Thank you very much.
And we'll have the final opening remarks before the discussion by Andrew Tettenborn.
Good morning, and I apologize to everybody for showing up as a disembodied head, but somebody up there seems to have wished me not to travel this weekend. I'm going to start, actually, by out-Joachiming Joachim. I come from a country which in the last 40 years has dropped from one of the most supportive of free speech to one of the most restrictive. And it makes me ashamed to appear before you. Only in the last few weeks, we have had somebody seriously prosecuted for silent prayer outside an abortion clinic. We have had somebody who was sent to prison for 2.5 years for a single tweet expressing what would have been expressed in any sports bar about the English unrest in Northwest England earlier this year. And only this week, we have had a comedian returning from Arizona finding himself arrested by 5 armed policemen on the basis of a tweet which insulted or apparently discombobulated a trans activist several months ago. And not to be content with that, we are doing our best to emulate the European Union. I don't know if any of you noticed, but with an entirely straight face and without laughing, a government department last week told an entirely US website, 4chan, which admittedly is not the kind of website that most of us would read, but never mind, it told an entirely US website, 4chan, that it was fining it £20,000 and would fine it daily sums beyond that for not promising to make sure that everything it said complied with English law and for failing to submit paperwork to the British government. In other words, Britain has fallen completely, how the mighty fallen. Now, the real question, I think, is what can you do about this? What are the remedies that need to be applied? And I'll be very brief. I think they are three. Firstly, I think it is now clear that you do require positive laws protecting free speech, like the First Amendment, and like you also have in Germany with the Grundgesetz. It's not enough simply to have a lack of legal regulation of speech, which is what Britain relied on for a long time. You cannot trust government. Government sooner or later will be hijacked by an interest group and will pass legislation to protect that interest group. It will say, oh, well, this is just one little restriction on free speech. This is something you should simply learn to put up with. And after a time, unfortunately, people get used to it. It's like the old proverb about boiling a frog. If you put the frog into boiling water, it will leap out. If you put the frog into cold water and boil it, it won't notice. The second point, I think, is that we do need a political impetus towards free speech. And that actually is something which John will know took some time to arise, even in the United States. Until about 100 years ago, the First Amendment was nothing like the powerful instrument that it is today. It took a change in judicial attitude, a change in political attitude, to say that the First Amendment should actually mean what it says and not be hedged around with all sorts of restrictions. And again, to take a couple of other examples, well, one, again, I will pick up from Joachim. So Article 188 of the Strafgesetzbuch is something which is as much the product of a political outlook as anything else. It is a feeling that something needs to be done about free speech, that people cannot be trusted to observe the rules, and therefore we must restrict it as far as possible. And I'm afraid it also extends to Switzerland, and I have no hesitation in saying this, as we are in Zurich. 12 years ago, the Swiss judge on the European Court of Human Rights produced a very memorable statement, which unfortunately is now forgotten. Now, quote, "Today's Europe cannot afford the luxury of a vision of the paramount value of free speech. I deceive you not." Those are his very words. The third point I want to make, and this will be my last, is that I suspect there may be a de facto connection between the value of free speech, which I think most of us here would espouse, and the value of the free market and the minimal state. Let me explain why. The excuse used by the state to limit free speech is invariably the need to protect a particular group. We need to protect people of a particular race, of a particular class, of a sexuality. We need to protect children. You know, that's what the English Online Safety Act is always said to do. But it always comes from the need to protect people from some real or imagined disadvantage. Now, one of the beauties of free market ideas is that you're prepared to say, well, sometimes, no, you don't get protected. You simply have to sink or swim. Now, with speech, that should be absolutely obvious. You are not condemning someone to abject poverty. You are condemning someone to have to put up with being insulted or with someone saying something that makes you feel uncomfortable. Now, I regard that as entirely acceptable. And it does seem to me that very often the distinction between those who don't believe in free speech and those who do maps very closely onto the contrast between collectivist and individualistic values. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm aware of the time constraints, and for that reason, I will leave it there and say no more. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. You know, this is something I think most people are very passionate about. You know, some of the things, I'll just have a comment and then I'll open up to questions. A couple of comments. One, this word misinformation and disinformation, it's shocking to me that the words even exist. They're nothing new, but I think the intent there is to demonize speech. But the only point of free speech is to have people say things that you don't want to hear. This is just such a common sense. There's such a lack of logic in the whole argument against free speech. And my comment is that what's shocking to me in the United States is that it is the younger generation in surveys that says we want protection from misinformation. We want censorship. And I would like to open a discussion with the question, is that something that we find in places like the UK and Germany and in Europe in general? Is this idea of more censorship actually traceable to younger people, which is the opposite of what it was in the world that I grew up in?
I can start with the United Kingdom. The answer is yes. It is students very much who call for example, the careful curation of reading lists, and it is young lecturers in universities who overwhelmingly are the people who say, well, the university must be decolonized, we must make sure that people don't read particular things that might offend them or amount to disinformation. It's not limited to the young. Our authorities have been just as guilty as they were over COVID. But if I went on to talk about that, nobody would get home until late this afternoon.
Okay. Joachim?
The best protection against disinformation, I think, is your brain and a good education, and not the state telling you what is true. Imagine the idea, the state finally decides what is true and what is not. It's an absurd concept. The second thing, this rule in Germany, and 188 in the criminal code, that was the first thing. If you fight disinformation and unlawful disinformation, the politicians practically invented a tool to mute themselves. Because, I mean, in every election cycle or out of it, politicians tell you a lot of things that could be considered disinformation. So, I mean, it's a completely absurd approach. And I think, where does it come from? Who is interested in that? Who wants to mute criticism and the challenge of your political views or the power constructs that we have, like political parties being in power, governments being in power, etc.? I think it's the state. And it's not only the parties that are in there, but the whole Leviathan. Is it pronounced correctly?
Leviathan.
See, I'll learn a little bit here. So this phenomenon wants to keep itself in power. And if that power structure is challenged by freedom of speech, they try, like I said, with the NGOs, they outsource entities to protect them in power by muting criticism and trying to delegitimize and criminalize criticism. So who, cui bono, the structures, the power structures profit most. It's not protecting people from being insulted in the feelings. That is absurd. And I mean, in Germany, we got a public broadcasting system that is subsidized by forced fees that you got to pay. Tell nobody, I didn't pay a single cent of my whole life. Somehow managed to get around, but I shouldn't say that because as soon as they realize, I will. But everybody has to pay, if you have a TV or not, to subsidize public broadcasters, 8 billion, and these are practically not purely propaganda machines, that is a very extreme description, but they, of course, generally supportive of everything that is in power of the government, of the structure. Disruption via these entities is impossible. So you get the state with the interest, you get the NGOs funded by the state, and you get the information tools of public broadcasters who replicate what the state wants to hear and be put in the brains of the people.
Can I go on to John asking for a specific comment about what you see in young people coming up in law schools themselves, the future lawyers, the future people who will be the constitutional scholars and the judges? Is there an assessment you can make about what that generation that you're seeing, if you can generalize, feels about this issue of free speech, and should it be restricted, or is that not something you see?
I don't want to depress everyone by talking about current law students, but one dynamic I've noticed only just in the most recently is that willingness to discuss controversial issues in classrooms has really declined. And it's not because of what goes on in the classroom. It's because my sense is it's because students are afraid of what people are going to say about them on social media about what they said in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And so every classroom now has become opened in a way to the whole world. Rather than just being the idea that you can say anything in the classroom, you may not even have to believe it as long as it's part of the common discussion that we're having to figure out the truth. And so this is why social media has come into the universities and I think is actually suppressing free speech in a way, but it's nothing directed by the university administrators or by the government. It is the social media companies in a way who enable this. So I have really struggled, and I know other colleagues have really struggled to figure out ways to try to reinvigorate discussion inside the classroom, but we're having a real lack of success. And so one thing I've been thinking about is, if you think about the founding of the country, a lot of our discussions were undertaken using anonymous names. You know, the Federalist Papers were written under the name Publius. I wonder whether some kind of way of anonymizing things is the way to go in order to protect speech from the sanctions of social media or your peers or the government in some way.
Yeah, I would just make an observation, then we'll take questions. The irony to me of social media was when it first came, I think people were saying, oh, this is fantastic. There's a free flow of information, a competition of ideas, and it turned into not just a sort of way to embarrass or cancel culture, but also a literal tool to censor speech. I was at a panel at a university discussion on censorship was the discussion. I went first and said what people would think I would say. And the next person worked at the Stanford Observatory, which is Stanford University's AI, a sort of effort that has been involved in censorship. And this person was very excited to discuss how AI was being developed with far more sophisticated algorithms in a very excited way, she said, to help refine censorship. This was a positive. I mean, this is really shocking and stunning. We don't want to be too negative, but I think it's very frightening. It makes the worlds of Orwell and Kafka and the absurd logic that they described a reality. Okay, open up for questions.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Lukas Dressel from Germany. You spoke about the origin of this. I want to ask again, who created this diversity matrix? What's the root? Is there a particular, can you take it more down? When you talked about paragraph 188 in Germany, I remembered myself of former communist German law against anti-state agitation, staatsfeindliche Hetze. Please, is there, can you pin it down to something?
Yeah, if you want, to something always. I think the problem started in Germany 2015. There was an open mic situation in the world of Astoria in New York when Merkel talked to Zuckerberg and said, in a nutshell, please mute criticism on my migration politics. Please mute that. And she didn't. He didn't do that. And then we had the Network Enforcement Act, which foresaw penalties up to 50 million euro, even for leading management of Facebook and the other social platforms, if they didn't delete fast enough. Evidently illegal, 24 hours, illegal, 1 week. Evidently unconstitutional. I was at the hearing as a visitor and later as an expert witness in parliament, and I really took them to task, these people, but it's like talking to a wall. When the first hearing before the law was passed, there were 10 witnesses, 10 experts. 8 were asked about the constitution, is this law constitutional? All said no, the law was passed. So I think the social media actually is a great tool for all of us to express ourselves, to criticize. There was no such tool before they were there. You could go to the media, to like Fox News or Wall Street Journal, or in Germany to public broadcasters or newspapers. You didn't have a voice. Now everybody has a voice. It has evident, massive, complicated downsides, challenging, especially for people who are not eloquent. But it's a big upside as well, and it's used like that in the US. Look at X now, it's free, which is great. So it's a big tool to go against government and to formulate criticism that otherwise is not accessible to the people. And that is a great thing. And this is why governments, especially in Europe, DSA, Network Enforcement Net, et cetera, went against it so massively and tried to delete whatever they can that went against their policies. They never had this. They were always like, they know their friends at the newspapers, they know their friends at the broadcasters, and say, yeah, okay, don't ask me too tough questions, some soft votes would be nice. And it worked like that, and they got away. Now this is over, and so it must be muted, and this is why government goes against it. I hope it answered your question. Otherwise, I hope it was an interesting answer, at least.
In the back.
Does the dominance of at-will employment mean private power, not public law, now sets the real limits of free speech?
Can I start with that one, actually? Because it's something which has been exercising us a great deal in the United Kingdom. One thing I didn't have a chance to mention is an enormous growth in the efforts of employers to put contractual restrictions on the views that employees are allowed to express, even entirely off the job. Now, in some countries, that's actually rather difficult. France, for example, has a very salutary legal principle that says that you have the right to freedom of speech, the liberté, and you do not hang up your liberté d'expression when you go and work for an employer. Unfortunately, England has no such restriction. In the United States, it's even worse because you do have at-will employment. But I think one of the things we are going to have to discuss one of these days, and I hesitate to say this in a generally free market organization, is that we may have to put some restriction on the contractual rights of employers to dictate to their employees what they can say. Obviously, there have to be restrictions on that. You can't have a clergyman, you can't have a priest saying they think the best of devil worship. But unless what the employee says is directly related to their job, there's a very strong argument that it's none of the employer's job to stop them saying it.
Personally, I don't think you have a right of free speech against your corporation. So if Microsoft wants to fire employees because they're having pro-Gaza war, you know, pro-Gaza or not pro-Hamas demonstrations at work, I think that's Microsoft's right, and that you have a competitive market. And if other employers are willing to hire you and allow you to have greater free speech rights, then employees can take that into account when they decide who to work for. So I think I disagree a little bit with our English colleague, but I think the I don't think if you look at the marketplace of ideas concept that we're harmed that much by allowing private employers to express the speech of their own employees, because is that really going to reduce the amount of ideas and the vigorousness of debate in the public sphere about public policy?
Is there Supreme Court precedent? Is this settled law, as they say?
I mean, the only area an employee has a right to speak is if you're a government. There's this questions about government employees, but right now in First Amendment law, private employers are allowed to condition your speech. So Microsoft is allowed to fire people, mm-hmm. for example, if they don't want to have pro-Hamas demonstrations on their campus.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hi, I'm Fleming from Germany as well. So thank you so much for all of your remarks on the very important issue of free speech. And I was particularly interested in your remarks, Mr. Steinhofer, because free speech has been under pressure in Germany for a while now. And I think it is a dire situation. I think people underestimate it, because from the outside, we still look like a democracy. But without free speech, there's no such thing as democracy. So my question would be, how free or not free or corrupted is the German court system, including also the police and law enforcement? Because I think your remarks, at least as far as I understand them, you have indicated that it seems like the higher entities are still siding with free speech and German basic law. But from like, at least from the media and from what you can see, it seems like especially the lower court entities seem to be very restrictive on free speech and going after people, and it seems like law enforcement is actually taking delight in like going after people. And so, yeah, what's your opinion on that? Yeah,
The legal system is not corrupted at all, especially not in civil law and administrative law. In the criminal area, it's a little different. There is an incredible amount of incompetence in the lower courts. They don't even listen to your case. They have no idea what freedom of speech means, and that it has to be observed all the time when they make a ruling. And state prosecutors are like recipients of orders from politicians, so they're not free to go after whoever they want. There were these three famous guys that 60 Minutes did a report on from Göttingen, who were sitting there and like laughing and giggling that they confiscated cell phones as a great achievement of a pre-dawn raid. So I'm very, very concerned regarding the criminal area where I mentioned a verdict, 7 months probation for holding this the Interior Secretary, who has a very bad record, who mocks the state, has to deal with a strong state, she said, which is a direct violation of the Constitution, which says you may mock the state, this is your constitutional right. And if the minister responsible for the Constitution says something that violates the Constitution, you may hold up a paper saying, I hate freedom of speech as criticism. Going to jail on probation 7 months for that shows what status the criminal system has, what is possible. And a prosecutor going on appeal because 7 months were not enough, he wanted 8. That is a degree of insanity and incompetence that is beyond my words. And this is not a single case. It's often, but not always.
Next.
I agree that free speech is in crisis, and I think it has to do with the undermining of Enlightenment values, which go back to, you know, John Stuart Mill or John Locke and the Letter of Toleration and so on, which has been abandoned by Europe. Now, you know, I did see this all my life because, you know, climate change, for instance, at school, it was taught to us any dissent was basically suppressed, but also in wider society with laws in Switzerland. So what I did is I set up the Free Speech Alliance in Switzerland together with two top professors, including the top jurist in Switzerland, to do something against this. So what we basically do is defend people who have been censored or cancelled in Switzerland. And we brought together the best people in Switzerland to help us do it on committees, including Mr. Rainer Eichenberger, who spoke earlier, who sits on one of our academic committees. And we're currently defending, just so you can see the kind of problems we have in Switzerland, we've provided 3 people with a lawyer in Switzerland, each of whom are being censored. One guy satirized racism in a TikTok video. He's being sued by the state authorities. The other guy criticized Hamas, saying never again is now, and showing a picture of an Israeli flag in the form of a fist smashing a Palestinian flag in the form of a Nazi cross. He retweeted that on Twitter, and he's a jurist, and he's being sued now for incitement to hatred. We're defending him in court. Another guy is basically a fan of Ludwig von Mises and Hayek and is an anarcho-capitalist. He has now been classified by the state authorities in Switzerland as a threat to the state. We are also, and he's being denied his lawful right to own guns, and they want to send him to a psychiatrist to have his head examined before he can actually buy and own guns, which is Stalinist. And we're defending these free people. But as Mr. Steinhoefel said, Germany is even worse, which is why we've now expanded our operations to Germany and brought together again some of the best people in Germany, such as Norbert Bolz, one of the prime philosophers, if not the prime philosopher, and media scientist, the best journalists like Roland Tichy and so on. So we're really steaming ahead, offering the same protection in Germany. But one thing I'd like to ask to Mr. Tettenborn, sitting, I presume, in Britain, what would you do in my situation or my organization, which provides lawyers, against something like the Online Safety Act, which has come into effect in Britain, which is very hard to tackle from that kind of organization, which you might compare to the Free Speech Union in Britain, what we kind of do. But in Switzerland as well, something like the Online Safety Act is on the cards. They are trying to introduce it through the back door and various means. But I'm not quite sure how you tackle that.
I think the only way to tackle it is eventually, well, obviously it has to be politically, and it has to be almost through ridicule. That was why I said actually earlier this morning that an agency of the British government had apparently been able to take itself entirely seriously by issuing orders to entirely American websites to jump to the tune of the British government. The more we can make the enforcers of the Online Safety Act look stupid, the better we're likely to succeed eventually in getting rid of it. The enthusiasm for the act, it's interesting to see, has already declined. The one maverick political party in Britain, which you may know is called Reform, is already pledged to get rid of it. And I suspect at least one other party in Britain is moving quite fast towards that position. In the end, all you can do is mobilize popular thought. And if that involves populism, then as far as I'm concerned, the more of it, the better.
Questions?
Hi. Is it on?
Yes.
Okay. Hi, Nick Iacono. I'm an attorney from Washington, D.C. Thank you all for the great discussion. There's an old saying, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. I'm known to many of my friends for being bullish on the scope of the right to free speech, but many of my friends on the left have come to me recently and said, you know, you on the right, Trump supporters, you decry cancel culture, but now we're seeing some things coming out of the Trump administration that sort of look a lot like that, going after some of the law firms that have historically been left aligned, reviving the notion of criminalizing flag burning is another. They've also cited to me the raids at John Bolton's house. So I'm wondering if you have a response to that criticism about how it's potentially different from what we've been seeing on the left. But more broadly, are you at all concerned that there may be a temptation on the right when they do get back, you know, the shifting of politics, when they do retake the reins of power? Is there a temptation, and should we be more vigilant of avoiding the temptation of adopting some of the examples on the left of cancel culture for thoughts and ideas and perspectives and speakers that we don't like?
After listening to what's happening in Germany and England, I'm bullish on the United States suddenly too. I mean, free speech is still, I think, best protected in the United States than most of our peer countries. Scott and I were trying to think of a country where free speech is in better shape than the United States, despite all the problems we have. And I couldn't think of one. But I think the questions you're asking have less to do with free speech than the problem of how you constrain government. So you could almost say that Donald Trump's success in politics is because he satirizes and pokes holes in this sort of PC atmosphere or woke atmosphere that dominates our cultural institutions. And so he expresses, I think, a lot of unhappiness with the American people have towards this ideology that's sort of suppressing free speech. But a lot of the examples you're talking about, I think, are responses to the way the left abused their own government power when they were in charge for 8 years under Obama. And then I think it just got worse under the 4 years of Biden. And the question is, and this was the part I was getting to, you know, playing defense, you know, using like the ACLU type approach to use the Bill of Rights as a defense to the government doing something to you is, you know, a minimal solution. But when the government can destroy people just by investigating you, they may never charge you, they may never throw you in jail. How do you stop that from happening? And I'm afraid, you know, my view is, for example, the only way you get woke prosecutors to stop prosecuting Donald Trump four times before an election, if you think about it, that's like an ultimate use of government power to try to interfere with a free election, is to try to prosecute the leading candidate of the major outside party, is you have to prosecute them back because there's no legal way to stop them, you know, stop prosecution itself, which, you know, Joaquin was talking about too. How do you stop prosecutors from abusing their power or government regulators? I think, unfortunately, in the American system, it has to be the threat of reciprocal treatment. It's sort of like mutually assured destruction or nuclear war, but applied to politics. And so I would say, when people say, well, there are these things that the right is doing, I would note that what the Trump administration seems to me to be doing is attacking the institutions that tried to suppress speech, like universities and like social media companies, rather than telling them what to actually suppress, which is what the Biden administration had done, as these lawsuits have made clear. So I think that's the only way to stop this abuse of prosecutorial power, because there's no other way in our system to restrain it.
Okay, I think in the interest of time, we're gonna have to end the, thank you very much. Great, great discussion, very important discussion. And I'll just finish the end of the conference with thanking all the speakers, all the participants. Special thanks to Anthony Curtis for doing all the work. And I would like to remind everybody that keep an eye on what we're doing. We do have newsletters, emailed things, as well as a website and social media presence, but I would like to encourage everybody to try to at least look at coming to our next event, which is in Palm Beach, Florida, February 27th. It's going to be great. I hope everybody enjoyed this as much as I did, and stick around for lunch. Thank you all for coming. Thank you.